This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome back, my friends, our dear listeners who follow this program as we march on in the quest to find answers to the most important questions that we have about life, reality, and the mysteries. Henrik is my name, and Red Ice Radio is available worldwide over the internet. RedIceCreations.com, that's the website. And we do get hits from almost all countries from around the globe right now. The stats recently, when I looked, said that we had hits from 219 countries. Then again, it's just 192 or so recognized countries as far as I know. So I guess if that doesn't include some of the microstates and islands that aren't supposed to exist out there who are tuning in, then we must have some of those off-world colonies, underground dwellers, or interdimensional web surfers joining us now and then too. Well, wherever you are from, we say thank you for tuning in today and for showing an interest in these topics. We have a riveting program for you today with Jay Widener. He's an author, filmmaker, and hermetic scholar, considered to be a modern-day Indiana Jones for his ongoing worldwide quest to find clues to mankind's spiritual destiny. He returns to Red Ice Radio to talk about his film Kubrick's Odyssey. Jay presents compelling evidence of how Stanley Kubrick directed the Apollo moon landings. He reveals that the film 2001, A Space Odyssey, was not only a retelling of Arthur C. Clarke and Kubrick's novel, but also a research and development project that assisted Kubrick in the creation of the Apollo moon footage. Welcome back to Red Ice Radio, Jay. It's great to talk with you once again. How are you? How have you been? It's been a year since we last talked, Jay.
Yeah, I'm doing good. It's really a pleasure to be here. And a lot going on in the world and with me, so I don't even know where to begin.
I know, there's so much going on. I think we should begin talking about Kubrick's Odyssey. We did that briefly last time we had you with us, but obviously the second volume has come out, and I think we definitely should touch upon this, because this is just a remarkable set of DVDs that you put together. I rewatched them again just before the show here we're recording right now, and they're excellent. Is there any way you can give us a little outline, encapsulate what they are about for newcomers, for those who haven't heard about this, Jay?
Yeah, basically. Stanley Kubrick, I discovered a buried symbolic language and subliminal images and various other cinematic devices into his films to try to tell a kind of a secret story. And that secret story is concerned with a lot of things that the people that listen to Red Ice would be concerned with. Not only is he telling us about that the world is ruled by a group of secret elitists who don't have our interests in mind, but he's also telling us that he was involved with faking the moon landings in a major way, and that he used the opportunity given to him by faking the Apollo moon landings to create a film, i.e. 2001, A Space Odyssey, that would, in a way, be a magical working that would alter the mindscape of the people, especially the younger people, the more malleable minds, I guess, who are watching it.
Yep.
And so he transmuted and transformed the baby boomer generation with the film. And I'm a member of that generation. I can tell you the endless amounts of discussion and conversations about 2001. It was astonishing. And so from there, my first one was about Kubrick and Apollo, and the second one is about the alchemical nature of 2001: A Space Odyssey. And the third one will be out a year from now, putting out one a year. and that will be out in April, I hope, of next year, if I can continue my work schedule at the pace I'm going. So,
excellent. Yep, absolutely. The first part one is kind of, it goes into some of the mechanics, if you will, or some of the techniques used. I definitely want to discuss some of this. It also goes quite into detail about The Shining, which, and I agree with you, when I first, you know, watched the film, it's like, what is this about, really? You know, it's very difficult to understand it. So I want to talk about that, too. And then the second one, of course, is, as you say, more about the alchemical nature of 2001, A Space Odyssey. What is the third one going to focus on, Jay?
Well, it's going to be, it was the one I was going to put out second, actually, Kubrick the Magician. But so much information has come in on that particular subject that I had to, I was going to put the 2001 Beyond the Infinite film out last, because it's such an optimistic and positive view of the world and of Stanley. But unfortunately, the information coming in on how Kubrick was trying to evoke a kind of a magical thing in his films is overwhelming me, and so I had to put the third one off. Because actually, a lot of people who've heard, you know, shows like your show have contacted me with new information, and it's really overwhelming. And now there's hundreds of people going through the Kubrick films frame by frame, which I'm really happy to hear. And they're, most of them are emailing me, and so we're uncovering really quite an astonishing array of different techniques and content which he has buried into his films. The thing you have to understand is that he was bored with filmmaking. By the time he got done with Barry Lyndon, he was just bored. It's pretty obvious from his writings and from what people tell me that he'd lost interest in it. And so he was trying, with The Shining especially, he was trying to make a new kind of film, a film that would be multi-layered, that you would have to spend, you know, literally years trying to decipher what he was trying to say in it. And it's really the culmination of his technical prowess is in The Shining, I think.
Absolutely. I definitely want to discuss that later, too. To understand the whole story of both of Kubrick's life and of his movies, I think we need to discuss that deal, if you will, that you argue in the beginning of the first one, that Kubrick accepted with the American government, and also obviously how this ties in to the elite. But what is this deal, Jay?
Well, you know, it's like any mafia or organized crime deal. Once the deal's offered to you, you really can't say no. So if you're ever in a position where you're getting offered a deal by a mobster or a criminal, it's probably best to get out of the deal-making process, because you're not really going to be able to say no to them. So I think Kubrick was smart enough to know that he had to take the deal. And it came to him, I believe, sometime in 1963, after Dr. Strangelove had come out, and they were very impressed, as was everybody, with the front screen projection work that Kubrick did in Dr. Strangelove with the airplanes, the B-52s, both inside and outside. The looking through the windows of the B-52 to the landscape of supposedly the Soviet Union, that's all front screen projection, Stanley's early work with it. And working on an extremely limited budget with no help from the Pentagon, because they read the script and they saw the subversive nature of the script, and they would refuse to assist him on it. So he just did it on his own, and they were really impressed with that. That's a well-known fact. And I believe that they contacted him to do the moon landings, and they offered him a deal he couldn't refuse, and if he did refuse, then he would disappear. And he may have even disappeared later because of that deal. We don't know. So the deal was offered, and I believe that he shot all the moon landings in 1964, early 1965. He cleverly used two studios in London, one studio where he did all the front projection work on 2001, and another studio where he did everything else. And so it was compartmentalized. And another thing that people don't realize, I get a lot of detractors we say, oh, the technicians would have seen what was going on mm-hmm. on the set, and they would have said, oh, you know, how could they hide it from that? Well, first off, this is 5 years before the Apollo landings. This is 64. He's shooting the stuff on 70 millimeter, and he's doing the front screen projection. But what people don't realize is the only people who can actually see the entire picture while you're on the set doing front screen projection is the director and the cameraman. You have to look through the camera lens to actually see what's going on. If you're just standing around on the set, it just looks like some guys walking around on a set. It doesn't look like anything. You wouldn't really even be able to tell what, as a technician, say a sound guy or a lighting guy, you really wouldn't even be able to tell what was going on outside of what the actors are doing. And because you can't really see the background projection. So this thing would only have been seen by Stanley, probably, because he was mostly his own cameraman. One of the very few directors that, at that time, who understood the technical side of filmmaking. Most film directors, especially in those days, were actually former theater directors, like Billy Wilder or
right.
any of these guys. And they didn't really understand. They depended on their technical guys to understand this. But Stanley came from the technical side and learned how to direct actors after he'd learned the technical side. So he had a serious advantage over everybody else that was making films. And I think that's another reason why they chose him, because not only did he understand the technical side, but he could direct the astronauts to do things right. And this always gets really interesting. So you have the astronauts who aren't really the astronauts, they're actors. They're wearing gold visors, so you can't see their face. They never really adequately explained why you have to wear these gold visors. But it sure makes it easy if you're trying to hide the identity. And they brought in, you know, a couple of the astronauts in for a little small shoot on Apollo 17 where you can actually see, I believe it was Schmidt's face behind the visor, you know, a couple times because, you know, they realized that the game was getting out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
And by Apollo 17, Kubrick was trying other tricks that would cause people to not see the front screen projection. I think he was starting to worry that the seams were going to get seen. And so he started doing a couple other techniques, which some people have used to prove me wrong. But I never, and what I'm talking about is I'm talking about the 360 pan that is in the Apollo 17 footage of the landing site at Apollo 17. The camera's moving in a 360 position, and everybody says, well, how could he do that in front screen projection?
Right.
And that's actually true. It's a very good criticism. But look at that scene, and you will see that what he did was he just did another technique that actually has been used in films before and since. And what he did was he took the same exact slide that he created the moon backgrounds, and he blew up the image onto gigantic pieces of photographic paper, and he put them in a circular room, pasted the giant images on the walls, and then he moved his camera around. And if you look, you can actually see it. It looks like photographs pasted up on a wall. And they, like in The Matrix, they did this with the scene where he's hanging from the helicopter.
Right.
That was actually shot in an Australian studio in Sydney. And what they did was they took pictures of Sydney and gigantic photographs and put them on the wall, and then they flew the actor in front of the giant photographs. It looks like he's flying above Sydney, Australia, and it looks perfect. And so, you know, he didn't just do front screen projection. He did a couple of other things. The other criticism that I get from people is that they move the camera around slightly in the Apollo footage, and that you can't move the camera around in front screen projection until the Superman movie came out in 1980, when they so-called discovered a technique to move the front screen projection in sync with the camera. Well, I hate to tell you guys this, but Kubrick's moving the camera in 2001 A Space Odyssey in the front projection scenes. So my thinking is that Kubrick perfected this technique that earlier than we think. In other words, it wasn't perfected in the Superman movie in 1980. It was perfected actually 12 years earlier by Kubrick, who possibly kept it secret and maybe even released the information to whoever made the Superman movie. So he is moving the camera in 2001. He's not moving it a lot, but he's moving it, and that's supposed to be impossible, yet he's doing it. And so I think Kubrick, you just have to realize that you're dealing with a guy with a very, very, very serious IQ, and he's working problems out that, you know, most people in cinema haven't even begun to consider yet.
Absolutely. I mean, he has scenes where the whole set is spinning with the camera. This is how he makes those scenes when they're seemingly walking around in zero gravity around this circular, you know, shape object. So this means, obviously, even if you have to have a two-way mirror, as you do in front screen projection at an angle of 45 degrees, and then, you know, at 90 degrees, you need to have the camera or the projector from the camera. This could you could literally have this going on at the same time. This whole set of these parameters moving, basically.
Exactly, and then let's just talk about another thing, which, you know, I'm not a moon hoaxer. I got into this because I'm a cinephile, and I really love movies, and I love the technical aspects of films. And you know, I got in because I saw something wrong cinematically. And so that got me into this. But, you know, as I got into the whole moon hoax, because of the criticism I'm getting, I actually had to start reading some of these moon hoax books. And a lot of it is kind of not very good research, but some of it is excellent research. But, you know, one of the things that has to be said is this whole idea that when you're in quarter G, supposedly 40% G of our Earth on the moon, that you would be walking around in slow motion. Mm-hmm. That's a complete fallacy, because you would have less resistance, not more resistance, in a lower gravity situation. You wouldn't be walking around in slow motion. You'd be bouncing around in a hyper motion. And and so what happened is that Kubrick on the set realized that he of course knew this. He was a smart guy, and he couldn't work it out. He couldn't get the astronaut actors or the astronaut actors in the movie 2001 to move in any way that you know looked real. And so he resorted in 2001 to showing everyone moving in about 65% slow motion. And what he did was that prepped us to think that walking around in zero G or in, you know, moon gravity would somehow be in slow motion. And he did that 1 year before the first Apollo landings, so that we were already thinking that that was completely fine without actually considering the fact that you wouldn't be moving in slow motion at all. And also there's another problem, which is that the suits, you know, you can watch the astronauts on these not very good videos, but you can buy these videos and you can watch the shots, and then the astronauts are in front of the camera, especially Apollo 14 and 15, for an hour or almost 2 hours, you know, without the camera ever being turned off. And not once in the entire 2 hour take of these guys do they once ever let out the carbon dioxide, which has to be building up inside their suits.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You never see any exhalation or crystals or steam or anything coming out of their suits, which, you know, just begs the question, where is the CO2 going? And, you know, after that, then you got the radiation problems. You've got the problems of that NASA has never done a soft landing. They tried one time with Neil Armstrong, and he almost lost his life in New Mexico. They never did it again. They've never done it since. Yet they did six soft landings on a foreign alien world that they've never been to without any technical glitches ever.
It's amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah. It's absolutely amazing.
Well, I mean, anyone who ever deals with technical problems, you know, knows that it's the first one or two times you try something, you're almost guaranteed 100% failure rate.
Yeah, look at all the initial rocket testing that they did. There was a lot of things going really, really bad there in the beginning.
Absolutely. And then things just went right, you know, after that. And then you got to wonder, you know, did Gus Grissom and the three astronauts who died in Apollo 1 in the fire, did he knew something about the deal had already been probably dealt with Stanley at this point, because that would be late 63, early 64. And so you wonder, was there grumbling going on in NASA about that they'd made the decision to scrap the actual launch and to go with the faking of it? And that may be the cause. I don't know. There's a lot of people that were making a lot of complaints back then who disappeared, frankly.
The fundamental question of why this was done is something we want to address, and the story, as you tell it, obviously, is told by Stanley in the movie The Shining. But if we look at it from the government / the elite's point of view, why did they want to do this? Why fake it if they indeed had the capability of actually going there, which could be debated, of course?
Oh, they had the capability of going to the moon. They'd already gone. They did it for a lot of reasons. The first reason, which is actually the weakest reason, is they didn't want to show our supposed enemy, which really wasn't our enemy, the Soviet Union, our stuff, which I don't really buy. But the second thing is that they wanted to save all that money and put it into black ops, mostly the secret space program, which was thriving and going very strong by this time. And third, they didn't want us to see what's really on the moon. I actually don't believe that any of the photographs that NASA has released of the moon, videos, films of the astronauts going around the moon or any of that, I have really highly questioned whether that is even real, any of that. NASA built a huge lunar model that was just a rough estimate, you know, 50 feet in diameter. And you can get it on YouTube and see it. And there's actually a 70-millimeter Panasonic camera on a jib photographing the moon as it spins on its axis. And then they just mysteriously, after they built this thing, meticulously built it using Mount Palomar photographs of the moon, and then right after the Apollo missions, they tore the whole thing apart. So donating it to a museum or something, they just tore the whole thing apart. So I'm not even sure that we can use any of the Apollo exterior footage, shots, photographs, imagery at all. So I resort to either Soviet imagery or lunar orbiter imagery, which was an unmanned mission that was done in 67 do two unmanned missions, actually. And those are the real deal, and there's stuff all over those photographs. Interesting, they're not photographs, they're video images. But interestingly enough, the data tapes that the lunar orbiter recorded all of its data on, I heard 5 years ago, were being stored in an empty McDonald's in Pasadena, California, and their magnetic tape is very, and this place does not have air conditioning, it's very hot in Pasadena, especially in the summer, and all of the oxide is flaking off of these tapes. And, you know, it's a bloody shame, and it really is. And so
is this allowed to happen, that they want this to disappear, this material?
Yeah, absolutely. Just like all the Apollo imagery has disappeared. It's mysteriously gone away. Just like they lost all the BBC, can't find any of their 911 footage from that fateful day. You know, this is the most important events in world history, and all the people who should be keeping archives can't seem to do it. You know, they just can't. It'd be like, you know, Columbus bringing along, you know, an archiver who on the trip back after discovering the New World just threw everything overboard because he didn't really think it was important.
The tapes have been erased. This is an easy way to rewrite history, of course, when we no longer can go back and look at the actual footage of the thing.
That's right. And it's really frustrating. I spent many years going to Houston and Ames and to Greenbelt, Maryland, to all the NASA archival sites looking at the Apollo imagery, and the state of affairs that they kept their their photography lab in. I'm a photographer. I worked in professional labs for a long time in my early 20s and early 30s, and the state of the condition that they kept their labs in was, it was absolutely a crime, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And they were they would use, instead of taking the original negative and making copies from it, or making a copy of the original negative and making copies of it, they were literally taking 8x10 photographs that were of dubious quality to begin with, slapping them under glass, and then photographing them, and then sending those out as the archival photographs. And that's just, you know, there's reflections on the glass, it was just criminal the way that they treated the material. I was getting really kind of angry at NASA when I saw the conditions of how they were treating everything.
Yeah.
And I brought it up to them, and they got really angry at me and then threatened to kick me off the property. And I didn't want that to happen to me. But what that did was, that got me thinking, why is there this cavalier attitude towards, you know, the greatest thing that this organization had ever achieved?
Right.
And the answer is pretty clear. The same thing is with Hasselblad. Hasselblad, you know, gives them the cameras that go to the moon, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And Hasselblad, you know, should be very, very proud of this, that their cameras went to the moon. But if you go to the Hasselblad site, or you look at any Hasselblad history or advertising all the way back from 1969 on, they never mention it. They're not proud of it at all. They don't say it at all in any of their history. They never mention in their company's history that they are the ones who sent their cameras were sent to the moon, and all the images were taken by Hasselblad. It's like, just again, begs the question, why wouldn't Hasselblad be just proud as hell that their cameras went to the moon?
Right.
And the answer is that they looked at the imagery when it came back and they went, you know, WTF, you know? What? You know? This is impossible.
Yeah.
I'm sure that. And I know people in Hollywood have told me that they knew that it was front screen projection by 74, 75, but they were all too afraid to say anything.
And they have the advantage on us, the audience in this case, because no one has ever seen how it looks on the moon, or how it should look, or even the technology that was used. Nobody had seen this before. So from our perspective, sure, this is the real thing, right?
Yeah, it's exactly right. And then, you know, they have the advantage on us completely, and they never really tell us. I mean, if you go to NASA and you say, hey, how come we never see the CO2, you know, going out of the suit anywhere, they don't answer you. I mean, they just ignore you, over and over. James Olberg, who is a top-notch science writer for NASA, he's a private science writer, but he's, you know, very well-respected science writer here in the United States. He got really angry when Fox came out with this special in the mid-90s about how we didn't go to the moon. It was actually a pretty good special. I think you can get it on YouTube.
Yep.
And it was a top-rated show, I think, for Fox. And Olberg saw it and got really kind of angry because, you know, they're saying that we didn't go to the moon. And so he contacted NASA. He said, I'm going to write a book. You open your archives to me. I'm going to write a book proving beyond any shadow of a doubt that we went to the moon. NASA gave him a $20,000 advance. They told him that he had complete access to everything. And about 5 months later, they canceled the project. And I'm certain that Olberg kept requesting, just like I did, certain kinds of files and documents, and he kept getting, you know, getting stiffed. And out of frustration, he just kind of said, forget it. And so he did not get to do it. Also, interestingly, Ron Howard was had decided to make a film about the Apollo landings, and he sent his screenwriter into NASA. They said they would cooperate with the entire production, and I believe the screenwriter also met this same kind of resistance. And eventually, I think that they threw their hands up and said, let's just not make a film about Apollo 11 or the Apollo program. Let's just make a film about the one time that we didn't go to the moon. That way, I don't have to worry about faking. Think about the dilemma.
Apollo 13.
Yes,
yeah.
The dilemma that you would be facing, having to use the Apollo footage as your template for a movie about the Apollo landings, and then when you make it, it just looks completely fake. And if you watch Apollo 13 and you see there's a dream sequence in which Tom Hanks has a dream that he's on the moon, that he's walking on the moon, mm-hmm. it's the only time in the movie that there's that, it looks completely fake.
So this is, exactly, think about this. Why not promote the incredible success of this and use this, you know, the propaganda arm of both the NASA, America, and the military, that this is the greatest achievements. Let's put it out there. No, instead they focus on the failure. Pretty interesting.
Yeah, in fact, they've never really made a movie about it. They did a TV series against Tom Hanks, did a TV series, which is probably one of the most boring TV series ever. And again, they stay as far away from being on the surface of the moon in this series as they can. They concentrate on the astronauts' love affairs, their alcohol problems. You know, it's like, wait, who cares?
Show us the moon. And, yeah, exactly. So, go ahead. Go ahead, Jay.
No, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the question of secrecy. If 2001, A Space Odyssey, and Apollo 11 then was shot approximately at the same time, was it the same crew? Any difficulty keeping this quiet? Or can we compare it to the success story of the Manhattan Project in terms of secrecy, Jay?
Well, first off, you're not going to need that many people. You're only going to need, I think at a bare minimum, you could actually do this with, besides yourself, four technicians, and then the actors who are playing the astronauts. And that's only two. So we're only talking six people. And I don't want to say this, but if there's an intrepid investigator out there, might behoove someone to go and check the technicians who worked with Kubrick on 2001 to see how many met untimely deaths soon after 1968 or 69. It could be 65 or 66 even on. It would be very interesting. It's really interesting. Robert Adams, I think that's his name, who was the production designer on 2001, wrote a book about his life and everything, and he has a part in the book addressing 2001, and he says that I showed up on the set. I showed up for my first meeting with Stanley, and he pulled out all the drawings for how everything in the movie should look. And I said, well, what do you need me for? You already did it. And that begs the question again, who did it? Who designed all these things before they brought in the production designer?
Yeah.
You know, and the answer is NASA designed them.
And in the credits, there's a lot of companies of 2001 that was also involved. Well, there is some parallels, right?
Well, they aren't in there anymore, interestingly. No, I have a list of the original credits in 2001, and all the major aerospace, Rocketdyne, all the major aerospace companies that were involved in the Apollo launches are given huge amounts of credit in the movie, and then those credits were removed. And now you won't see that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's curious even on itself. The question then becomes, for what reason are these companies helping Stanley? How much did he pay them to do this? Why is NASA sending Fred Ordway, their top advisor, when he should be working full-time on the Apollo missions? Why is he spending most of his time in London with Stanley instead of in Houston? And this just goes on and on. Carl Sagan, Arthur C. Clarke, all the intelligentsia of the elite are hanging out with Stanley in London during this entire time. NASA people are coming in all the time. And I think we can see what's going on here. And think about it, it's even better if you think about it, that they did it in London, you know, as far away from the United States as you could get. It just really makes it easier to do.
Frederick Ordview, what is his name again? He was in there.
Ordway,
right?
Frederick Ordway.
Yes.
Yeah, he's a top advisor to both the Apollo program and to 2001 Space Odyssey. And he's you know, one of the best friends of Arthur C. Clarke, and he worked with Wernher von Braun and Hermann Oberth and all of these top guys, and there's so many connections between 2001 and the Apollo landings that in itself could be an entire book or investigation.
Absolutely. So while NASA, the government, and the brotherhood behind all this try to, in a way, erase the evidence and downplay it, and not encourage even conversation around this, Kubrick, in your view, actually chose to tell the whole story in The Shining. This is absolutely fascinating. Tell us about this, Jay.
Yeah, so Kubrick really wanted to tell the story, and he was also bored with filmmaking. And so he was looking for the right device, I think, to tell the real story. And he came upon the Stephen King book, The Shining, and chose it. It was a bestseller, so he knew he would have a ready-made audience. So he chose that book then he proceeded to kind of gut the book and rewrite it. And he just, you know, left so many clues, that some very obvious and some very inobvious. The basic plot, the basic trick to The Shining is that every time that Kubrick deviates from the Stephen King novel, he's telling you the story that he wants you to know.
Yeah.
So Stephen King was incredibly vexed by the movie, an angry outburst after he saw it, just trashing Stanley and everything. And frankly, I would have been, you know, angry too if I was Stephen King, because a lot of reasons. Kubrick just kind of dismissed a lot of the what were really, really been really good cinematic elements and dumped them. And I think this really kind of angered Stephen King too. And of course, then there's the famous scene where the red Volkswagen is crushed by the semi truck. In the book, The Shining, of course, Jack Torrance has a red Volkswagen. In the movie, he has a yellow one. And Kubrick, by showing the crushed red Volkswagen, is basically, you know, telling Stephen King that this is my vehicle, not yours. And this is what I think.
This is the switch happening there. Why do you think that Kubrick chose to even use a novel? This is what I was kind of struggling with. Why not even write the movie from scratch in the beginning, or he used this framework? Why, do you think?
To hide, better disguise what he was doing, because he was faking the making of a Stephen King novel to show you that he faked the Apollo moon landings. And he's constantly doing that. I call him Kubrick's ironies. So you have A Clockwork Orange, which is a movie about a guy, a psychopathic killer, actually, who gets mind control by sitting in a movie theater and being given a drug that makes him sick, and then showing him images of sex and violence, so that at any time that he comes up against sex and violence for the rest of his life, he gets ill. And Kubrick's pulling a delicious irony on you, because he's doing that to you while you're watching it. You're sitting in the theater, and he's mind-controlling you through the images you're watching on the screen to actually like a psychopathic killer whom you shouldn't like at all. But he gets you to like Alex, and you begin to cheer on Alex and to support Alex in all of his macabre endeavors through the film. And that is, and this was really disturbing to a lot of people who saw Clockwork Orange. They were disturbed by this, it was Kubrick proving to you right there on the spot that he could mind control you. And in and he's doing the same thing in The Shining. He's telling you something right to your face, and no one's seeing it. He's telling you that there's a room room 237, in which nothing real happens. Yet everything that goes on in this room, that where nothing real happens, has profound effects on everything. Just like the Apollo lunar stage, nothing is real, yet it's having a profound effect on history and on everything. He's telling you that he's trying to hide what he's really doing from his wife. And I think this was a really big dilemma. He was very close with his wife, and she helped him on productions. I painted the paintings in Clockwork Orange and did a lot of other things for him. And suddenly he had to hide from his loving wife what he was doing during this, because he was afraid if she found out that she would get killed. And she found out, and it's really the story of that. Again, when he deviates. So the deviation in the movie is the scene where Shelley Duvall, Jack Torrance's, Jack Nicholson's wife, finds the book in which he's just writing the same sentence over and over, "All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy." And, it's really actually a very frightening scene. It's not in the book. And this is a story of Christiana Kubrick, I believe, accidentally stumbling in on the set of the moon landing, mm-hmm. and realizing that he's doing this, and then and her saying, "You've got to quit. You can't do this." And I think it's the most important scene in the movie. And it is the argument between Shelley Duvall and Jack Nicholson. And Jack Nicholson kind of reveals the whole thing he says to her, "Do you have any idea what a contract means? Do you know what it means to have an obligation to your employers? Do you know what they would do to me if I didn't fulfill my obligations to them?"
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa, man. You're just a janitor and caretaker. It's not that big a thing, you know?
Yeah. But it is, the endeavor he's taken on here is quite the task, and even the way, I mean, the analysis you make is fascinating, very very interesting, and it's an excellent case that you for this, of course. The hotel, the Overlook Hotel, is America. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, it's America, and Stuart Ullman, who's the manager of the hotel, has a wig which makes him look like John F. Kennedy, which makes me think that he may have been in discussions with Kennedy early on, soon after Dr. Strangelove was finished and before Kennedy was killed. And I'm not sure about that, but I think that might be so. And you can see they walk right over Native American symbols. There's Native American symbols all over the wall. Unlike the Stephen King novel, the Overlook is built over an Indian burial ground. So literally the spirits of the Native Americans are, permeating the atmosphere, that kind of thing. This was all done on purpose by Stanley to show this. And I'm actually not the first one to pick this up. There's many other people who have, I think, outlandish interpretations of The Shining, who also seen that, it looks like the Overlook is America.
Yeah.
But there's other interesting things. There's fascinating research on a hotel that was in Laurel Canyon in Los Angeles that burned down, I believe, in the 80s, and it's a dead ringer for the Overlook Hotel in The Shining. And this hotel is very interesting because it was a CIA front in which they basically created the 60s out of this hotel. They created the rock music that came out of Los Angeles. Frank Zappa, who lived nearby this hotel, which overlooked Los Angeles, he used to tell people, I know one of Frank Zappa's friends, and he used to tell people that the entire hippie movement was created by the CIA right out of that hotel. And there's great work on the internet on this. Google Laurel Canyon, Overlook Hotel, 1960s, and you'll see that groups like the Mamas and the Papas and the Byrds and all of these LA-based bands were created out of this hotel. And Kubrick lived in L.A. and when he was making Spartacus and The Killing, and he lived there for a while, and he knew about this place. And he was once asked by a reporter why he moved from L.A., why he didn't live in L.A., and Stanley said, L.A. has a malignancy floating above it.
Don't deny that.
Yeah. So Kubrick went there, he saw it, and he hated it, and you know, he moved to London, you know, for various reasons.
Right, right. The one of the most obvious giveaways is the scene when Danny, the little boy, is sitting on the interesting patterned carpet, and he stands up with that sweater with the Apollo 11. Tell us about that briefly.
Yeah, it's really the culminate scene, I think, the ultimate scene in the movie. Danny is playing with his trucks in the hallway, and Kubrick has a really great shot, above shot of Danny playing, and you see the hexagonal pattern on the carpet, and you know, I googled in a launchpad 39A, which I knew was the launchpad that Apollo 11 had gone off of, and you know, until Google Maps, you really couldn't see Launchpad 39A. Not really. Maybe if you went to a NASA site, and not a site, a location, and looked, you might actually see what it looks like from above. But fortunately, Google Maps shows it, and you know, it's really, really close to the pattern that's on the carpet, including the driveway that leads up to it. And what's interesting about that is, as soon as it's established, that shot is established, the ball, of course, rolls down the hallway coming from nowhere, and Kubrick then cuts to a shot that's actually behind Danny, looking down the hallway. It's very subtle, but if you look, what he's done is he's either torn out the carpeting and reversed the carpeting, or he reversed the entire set. I guess it would be easier to take care of the carpeting than reverse it. And you have to ask yourself, why would he go through all of that effort to reverse the pattern on the floor? And the answer is because he knew that he was saying just a little too much. And if he left that pattern on the floor through the entire scene, then it might get seen. So it's really only in that one shot that you see this hexagonal pattern. So the ball, which Jack Nicholson had thrown into the hotel earlier and disappeared, now rolls at Danny, you know, as if to say, like the twins that were murdered, you know, come play with us. And so Danny stands up, and then we see that on his chest, on his torso, is a crudely sewn Apollo 11 rocket taking off, and it says Apollo 11.
That's right.
And Danny takes off. He stands up from the launch pad and stands up with the picture of a rocket with exhaust coming out of it, with the words Apollo 11 on it, stand up, and then he walks across the carpet, down the hallway, towards the room that in the book was called numbered 217, but Kubrick, ostensibly for other reasons, he says, change it to 237, and he walks towards room 237, and the door is open, there's a key in the door, and it's exactly the mean distance, especially in 1968. With lasers, we've gotten a little better measurements since then. But in 1968, and in all of the textbooks, lunar astronomy textbooks and everything, the mean distance of the moon from the Earth is 237,000 miles exactly. Hmm. And so he changed the name, or changed the number, to match the distance of the Earth and the moon. So Danny takes off from the Earth, i.e. the launch pad. He travels the distance, 237,000 miles, of course, all symbolically, not real. He gets to room 237. There's a key in the door, and on the door it says, there's letters, say room number, R-O-O-M, and then the old style number, N, and a small O. And if you take just the large capital letters there, R-O-O-M and the N, and you try to make any words in English out of them, you're going to only get two words. You're going to get moon and room. Hmm. And it is indeed the Moon Room, which is probably what Kubrick called it, by the way.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. Did someone eventually realize what he had done? And with the Eyes Wide Shut, this was the final straw, and he was killed. What do you think?
I do. I do believe that. I mean, I hate to say, because I can't really say that he was killed, and I hope he wasn't killed. But, if somebody says to me, you know, you're just a conspiracy theorist, and I have a comeback line, and my comeback line is, well, then I guess I get to call you a coincidence theorist.
Yep.
And so, you know, is it a coincidence that he dies right after he shows the movie to the studio executives? I suppose it could be. I've just finished a feature film, and I know how much work it takes to do a shoot. With actors, and you know, you're blowing $5,000 an hour, and it's really a lot of pressure and stress.
Yeah,
and so I know that it could have killed him. It got almost killed me, and I'm younger than he was. But
he went through this kind of transformation as well, both in looks and behavior, I think.
Oh yes, he really, really deteriorated quickly.
Yeah.
He looks really not very good the last 10 years of his life. But he also is running into all sorts of problems with his daughter, who converted to Scientology and refused to come home to visit him. The same girl, the daughter who shot the making of The Shining, which is a very revealing documentary. And that broke Stanley's heart. And I just find it odd that, you know, he cut a deal with the two most famous Scientologists on Earth, you know, 5 years after his daughter left London to move to Los Angeles and became a full-time Scientologist. I don't know what the backstory is there, but there are rare, very interesting parallels between L. Ron Hubbard, Naval Intelligence, NASA, Scientology. And you really have to start wondering exactly what is really going on there.
Jack Parsons, the Babylon Bunch, as they were called. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up. So, you know, Jack Parsons, who's really one of the very first guys who created what later became NASA, his wife was, you know, left him for L. Ron Hubbard. And Scientology, when they are asked about all these, this episode that L. Ron did with Jack Parsons, you know what their answer is? They actually say that L. Ron Hubbard infiltrated the coven in Pasadena that where Jack Parsons that for naval intelligence. That's the cover story, they say. Huh. So they're actually admitting that he was infiltrating it for naval intelligence. Hmm. And we know that the Navy is the military behind NASA. That's the supervising military organization. NASA is, in essence, a naval operation. And I believe that the entire secret space program is actually operated out of the Navy.
Yeah.
Because,
What was that with the Space Command? Was it, I mean, I first thought that there was Air Force, but I think you're right. I think that was under the Navy as well.
It was, because they called their guys admirals. Gentleman who hacked in, I'm going to forget his name now.
Gary McKinnon.
The gentleman thank you. He said that they called them admirals, that the heads of the ships were called admirals.
Yeah.
And I was like, there you go. You know, and it is. And the Navy, it's not well known, but the Navy is the only constitutionally sanctioned intelligence gathering agency in the United States. All the other ones are not constitutional. CIA, the NSA, none of these are mandated in the Constitution. But the Constitution did mandate a naval authority and intelligence for tariff gathering. So people, you know, smugglers, to make sure that smuggling operations were curtailed. That was really the duty of the U.S. Navy at the beginning, was really not to defend the place, but to stop smuggling and make sure tariffs were collected. And so when the CIA was created in 1947, a lot of people in the Navy really were angry, because they did not like the fact that there was a rogue operation not under their control. And there's been a war, actually, since then, between naval intelligence and the CIA. And there's a lot of talk of several Navy intel organizations going rogue in fighting this war.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at Jimmy Carter, he was in naval intelligence. And then you look, and he is thrown out of office in a very suspicious incident with the helicopters in Iran. And then you see that the vice president of the next guy, Ronald Reagan, is ex-CIA, put quotes around the ex, ex-CIA, and that Jimmy Carter and his CIA head, Admiral, I'm going to forget his name too, he was also in the Navy.
Michael Aquino, fired, maybe?
Admiral,
no,
I can't remember his name.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Anyway, he was an admiral under Jimmy Carter, and he ran the CIA before George Bush took it over under Jerry. But Jerry Ford hired Bush, and then Bush left, and Carter hired this admiral, and this admiral did something. He did something called the Halloween Night Massacre, in which he fired thousands of CIA people in one fell swoop because they, I heard, were operating on a treasonous level, a rogue element level, and it's no coincidence that it was an admiral that did this firing, and they are the ones who destroyed Jimmy Carter, and they became a rogue element, and that later surfaced with Ollie North in the Iran-Contra scandal.
Wow, fascinating. I want to take a break here in a little bit here, but I wonder if this could have something to do with the fact that this is admiralty law, the maritime law system, and for I don't know how it exactly is on paper, but you know, at least from an esoteric point of view, you could make the comparison between the ocean and the stars or space.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Fascinating that you brought that up, because here's the thing. If you're under admiralty law, the Navy is under admiralty law, they can operate internationally without any problems, because that's admiralty law. The CIA is told that they can operate under admiralty law. They cannot operate inside the borders of the United States, i.e. under the land law of the United States. And, but of course, they're not keeping that. And they are operating here. They're operating out of Indian reservations and trying to do various ways to get around it. But we know that they're operating here locally in the United States and in direct violation. And this also really pisses off the Navy.
There's many more clues in The Shining and, of course, in the first DVD that we have primarily been talking about here, Kubrick's Odyssey, Secrets Hidden hidden in the Films of Stanley Kubrick. And the part one is called Kubrick and Apollo. So much more to it, and we've only scraped the surface. And if you want to know more, I highly recommend that you pick up a copy of this DVD by going to sacredmysteries.com. And in the second segment here, we're going to begin in a bit, Jay, I want to talk more about the second film and go into some of the alchemical stuff, because that's fascinating in itself. But sacredmysteries.com, that's the main website. Is there anything else you want to give out in terms of info or material, Jay, before we take a break?
Yeah, go to jaywidener.com also and get my articles. And I have a feature film coming out this September called Shasta, which is about the return of Kalki, the 10th avatar of Vishnu, who's prophesied to come at the end of the cycle and destroy the enemies of truth. And I've been waiting 30 years for Kalki to return, and he hasn't returned, so I decided to make a movie where he returns.
Okay, well, sounds interesting. jaywidener.com, sacredmysteries.com, the new film Shasta, beyond the Kubrick material. Stay with us, Jay. We'll be right back with more.
Thank you.
In the next hour, Jay Widener reveals that besides being a great science fiction movie, 2001 is also a multi-layered revelation concerning the human condition and our place in the universe. Widener unveils new insights into this most mysterious of films and shows us that Kubrick was telling us another story underneath the story we are watching on the screen. 2001, A Space Odyssey is actually a work of alchemy, a film that initiates the viewer into a higher consciousness and opens the mind and heart to new vistas for the entire human race. Kubrick used powerful symbols in 2001 that were designed to reveal the secret of transformation and the path to our spiritual evolution. Don't miss this next hour with Jay Widener. RedIceCreations.com is the website, and you should acquire a 3-month membership today to get access to the entire website. The majority of what we do for free, and we have no commercial interruptions, so your support is appreciated so that we can proceed, continue, and expand. That is the idea. Sign up for a membership if you haven't already and get access to an archive filled with goodies for you and for your friends or family. We have some excellent programs coming your way next on Red Ice Radio. William Davis on the health dangers of wheat, then Mark Weber on historical review, Germany, World War I and II, and how this has shaped the political landscape today. Then we have Mary Sean Young, the actress from Blade Runner and Dune, coming on the program. Very interesting, and a different guest as well. We're going to be talking about her own awakening and how she got into these kinds of topics. That should be a lot of fun. Then we have Kurt Lindahl, Holland van den Nieuwenhof, Louise Turry, Tom Horn, Cliff High, Dean Clifford, Jordan Maxwell, Peter Halderson, Neil Kramer, Richard Merrick, Nora Gedgaudas, and Alex Newman. All the details are on the website, redicecreations.com. J, Hour 2 is up next. Don't miss it.